for this by taking us back to what we talked about last week and bringing that refreshed back up in the context of what we've been talking about this week. So we'll take an idea which was first given to you last week and we'll refresh that idea, restate that idea through the examples in the new context of what we are talking about and understanding this week. Go here back to Shakespeare and back to Marlowe. In Dr. Faustus, because of the compulsive nature of the projection of the self in Dr. Faustus, Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, the Spiritus Mercurius is a minor figure and is a buffoon. And the figure is named Robin in Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. I'm beginning here with lines 922. Dr. Faustus, 922. Enter Robin, the ostler, with a book in his hand. And Robin says, "Oh, this is admirable. Here I have stolen one of Dr. Faustus's conjuring books. And in faith, I mean to search some circles of my own use. Now will I make all the maidens in our parish dance at my pleasure, stark naked, before me. And so by that means I shall see more than e'er I felt or saw yet." Enter Rafe, who's calling, "Robin, Robin, Robin, pray thee, come away. There's a gentleman tarries to have his horse, and he would have his things rubbed and made clean. You keep such a chafing with my mistress about it. She has sent me to look thee out. Pray thee, come away." "Keep out, keep out, or else you are blown up. You are dismembered, Rafe. Keep out, for I am about a roaring piece of work. Come, what dost thou with that same book thou cannot read?" "Yes, my master and mistress shall find that I can read. He for his forehead, she for my private study. She's born to bear with me, or else my art fails. Why, Robin, what book is that?" "What book? Why, the most intolerable book for conjuring that e'er was invented by any brimstone devil." So there's the spirit Mercurius in the Faustus theme. Notice that Dr. Faustus is a myth. Faustus is a powerful mythic image, and his story is the myth of Dr. Faustus. In that myth, in that mythological horizon, the spirit Mercurius is subsumed as a kind of an idiot. The best thing he can think of that magic might be used for is to compel women to be naked. A Midsummer Night's Dream is not on the mythic level at all, but is on the magical level. It is passed through someone's symbolic self, Shakespeare's. It's written not to convey the myth, but to convey a fairy tale which that symbolic self has understood about the process in which it is involved itself. The process of what? Of becoming real. The process of emerging as a person. And that the centerline structure of that emergence is the reconciliation of opposites. The bringing of polarities together. How are polarities brought together? On the mythological level, they cannot be brought together, because it's the polarity that gives structure to the mythic level. The mythic level collapses if you reconcile the opposites. Can't be sustained. There's no interest in the plot, to put it mildly. If there are no complications, you don't have a plot. You get bored with the story. On the fairy tale level, the reconciliation of opposites is the storyline. The structure is not the maintenance of the polarity, but the transformation of the polarity into a complementarity in the emerging unity. That's what the story is. So the storyline in a fairy tale is quite different from the storyline in a myth. In a fairy tale, the purpose is to get to that part where the frog turns into a prince. The whole object of the fairy tale is to come to that. Tolkien, who is the most masterful storyteller in the fairy mode of the 20th century, had a beautiful word. He couldn't find a word. And the reason why he couldn't find a word is that there was never a poignant self-consciousness about this process until the 20th century. It's only in our own time that there's been enough self-consciousness about this exact detail of the process to give it a name. And Tolkien gave it a name. He said that that moment is a eucatastrophe. Instead of a catastrophe, it's a joyful catastrophe, a eucatastrophe. And he says the whole structure of a fairy tale is that it has, right at its end, at the fulcrum of its purpose of expressiveness, a eucatastrophe. When beyond hope, one emerges free. So that there's a miraculous quality. The miracle stories in the New Testament about Jesus are fairy tales delivering this eucatastrophic moment. That's what the miracle stories are about. Miracle in the sense that beyond all natural conditions and limitations, one still emerges. That the human person is a magical creation. Unbelievable that it could happen. That on a natural level, one scrambles and looks for the evidence. How can this be? This seems impossible, or at least improbable. But on the fairy tale level, it still is true, regardless of how improbable. In spite of its impossibility, it in fact happened. Just now did happen again. So that a fairy tale, like A Midsummer Night's Dream, has that most miraculous moment. How does that eucatastrophic moment happen? Because what is operating is that all of the creative energies, the flow of the imaginative capacity, instead of being sapped in a projection, are held into the deep self, and the deep self guarantees that that happy ending will happen, no matter how improbable. Or even if it's impossible, it still will happen. The old saying is, what is beyond God? If he wants the moon made out of green cheese, it'll be made out of green cheese. It's like that kind of the word is power, but I have to use the Greek term dynamis. That kind of a dynamis that smacks of psychologisms in our time. I don't mean it in a jargon way. I mean to say that's the way the creative energy flows. That when the conditions are ripe for the person to emerge, no matter how improbable, the person will still emerge. That the emergence of the person is like one of those ultimate miracles. And the closest thing that we know to it in the natural world is a birth. You see a birth, and you have to be pretty far gone on something not to appreciate the incredibility of that, the way that baby comes out. There it is. No matter what you think, that baby has still come out. There it is. Better dry it off. Wrap it and feed it. It's like that. It's like the birth is the only natural happening which comes anything near and yet isn't really as powerful as the rebirth. And the rebirth is the emergence of the person. Not that the person is reborn, that's a complete misunderstanding. The emergence of the person is the rebirth. From where? He's reborn from the deep self and comes out like that. And it happens just like a birth happens. Actual event. Actual threshold. That person is there. And when the person is there in that way, you can't stuff them back in. Just think of the natural parallel. You're going to stuff that baby back in the womb? You're going to have a hard time. It's like that. Here is Robin in A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's a different tone from Robin in Faustus. This is Midsummer Night's Dream, line 18 in the second of the five sections. Maybe I'll give you the whole section, so you can see how Shakespeare masterfully expresses it. He was about 30 years old and just bouncing as a newly emerged person at this time. Shakespeare emerged as his own person. He was about 30 years old when he was. When he was 12 years old, traveling circus came to his town, Stratford, and his father took him to this traveling circus, and they had there a little weir in the Avon, in the river, and made a pool. And part of the circus was that they had this model of a dolphin and a boy riding on the dolphin. The Greek name of the boy is Arion. And Arion is the first maker of poetic verses, the discoverer that language can be shaped into like quatrains and couplets and things. And the image of a boy and a dolphin who is able to sing poetry started to wake up the 12-year-old Shakespeare, started to break him out more or less dull world in which he had been raised. And from the time he was 12 and he got that first insight, in Buddhism it's called the bodhicitta. The first moment that it occurs to you, even subconsciously, that there is such a thing as enlightenment. And then it works its own way. It's like a magical seed. It works its own way and blossoms. From 12 until 30, he grew, and in Midsummer Night's Dream, this is when he stood free as a human being, fully in his own right. And here's the way Robin, and Robin is given his full name by Shakespeare, Robin Goodfellow. Notice the symbolism, Robin Goodfellow, or known as Puck. In come enter a fairy at one door, and Puck or Robin Goodfellow at another. And both at the Globe and the Blackfriars, when the play was produced, the doors by which they entered were at opposite ends of the arena, of the stage. Polarity, still. In comes the spirit, in comes Puck, and says, "How now, spirit, whither wander you?" And the spirit said, and the fairy says, "Over hill, over dale, through bush, through briar, over park, over pale, through flood, through fire, I do wander everywhere, swifter than the moon's sphere, and I serve the fairy queen," who's inside. And there's a fairy queen, Titania, inside. If she were projected outside, damn the witch. "To dew her orbs upon the green, the cowslips tall her pensioners be, in their gold coats spots you see, These be rubies, fairy favors. In those freckles live their savors. I must go seek some dewdrops here, and hang a pearl in every cowslip's ear. Farewell, thou lob of spirits, I'll be gone. Our queen and all her elves shall come here anon. And Puck says, the king doth keep his revels here tonight. Take heed the queen come not within his sight, for Oberon is passing fell in wrath. Not that he's passing by, it's that he's surpassingly fearsome when he gets ticked off. For Oberon is passing fell in wrath, because that she, as her attendant, hath a lovely boy stolen from an Indian king. She never had so sweet a changeling, and jealous Oberon would have the child knight of his train to trace the forests wild. But she perforce withholds the loved boy, crowns him with flowers, and makes him all her joy. And now they never meet in grove or green, but fountain clear or spangled starlight sheen. But they do square that all their elves, for fear, creep into acorn cups and hide them there. She's fallen for something outside of her own realm. An Indian boy. What is this? It's not Indian. This is the New World. And an American Indian boy. She's fallen for new possibilities in the New World. Instead of finding your own self, you think, well, maybe I'll find my own self over there. Oh, well, that's where it is. It's got to be over there. It's not here. It's askew. And in Shakespeare's time, it's beginning to be a problem. This was written about 1595. And in the 1580s, Sir Walter Raleigh tried four different times to make his millions in the New World with various adventures, and all of them ended up in slaughtering the Indians. All of them. He's the one that went searching for El Dorado down in Venezuela. He's the one that went to Virginia to try and find where all the gold is there, and made a mess of things. Fairy says, either I mistake your shape and making quite, or else you are that shrewd and knavish sprite called Robin Goodfellow. Are not you he that frightens the maidens of the villagery, skim milk, and sometimes labor in the quern? Right? In other words, he's saying, aren't you the one that causes all the little problems and trouble? Aren't you the gremlin in the works? And bootless make the breathless housewife churn, and sometimes make the drink to bear no balm, mislead night wanderers laughing at their harm. Aren't you the one that sours the milk? They're trying to churn it into butter and they get soured milk. Those that hobgoblin call you and sweet Puck, notice the polarity in him, hobgoblin and sweet Puck, you do their work and they shall have good luck. Are not you he? Aren't you the spirit Mercurius? Thou speakest aright. I always see in my mind's eye Mickey Rooney doing it in the film. Thou speakest aright. I am that merry wanderer of the night. I jest to Oberon and make him smile. When I a fat and bean-fed horse beguile, neighing in likeness of a filly foal, and sometimes lurk I in a gossip's bowl, in very likeness of a roasted crab. And when she drinks, against her lips I bob, and on her withered dewlap pour the ale. The wisest aunt, telling the saddest tale, sometimes for 3-foot stool mistaketh me, then slip I from her bum, down topples she, and Taylor cries and falls into a cough, and then the whole choir hold their hips and loft, and waxen in their mirth and sneeze, and wear a merrier hour was never wasted there. But room, fairy, here comes Oberon. Notice that Puck's polarity, his tricksterism, has a shape when Oberon is present. When Oberon is present, Puck, who is still Puck, has a place to be. And the fairy says, "And here, my mistress, would that he were gone." And enter then the king of the fairies in one door with his train, and Titania the queen at another with hers. Again, they're polarized. And they're trying to come together, but they can't quite come together. They aren't quite the king and queen of the fairies. All is not well in the magical realm. Why? She's thinking of something else. She's thinking of the little Indian boy. She has her energies projected someplace other than the presence which they are. And later on, it turns out, after they have their discussion, that Oberon figures she needs to be shown that as long as you're going in this projective way, you're open to any complication that the world brings to you. As long as you're distracted in this basic way, you're open to any kind of a complication to come in and fill that distracted avenue. You think that you want such and so. But the structural realization is that your willingness to project out leaves you open to any kind of content that comes in and may not be what you want at all. That's where the complication with she falls in love with Bottom, who has the ass's head on him, and goes through all of this kind of strange thing. So here's the deep self, Oberon, who's now going to play devil's advocate to press the issue for Titania to the breaking point. And who does he use? He uses Puck, who's that energy for that. Puck is willing to be Robin Goodfellow, and he's willing to be Hobgoblin at any time, for any purpose whatsoever. He's never going to change. A good Puck I am. What fools these mortals be. So he says, after Titania goes, Oberon speaking to Puck, the deep self talking to the Spiritus Mercurius, who is now going to play devil's advocate, going to show the soul, oh, you want greener pastures, do you? Well, go thy way. Thou shalt not from this grove till I torment thee for this injury. My gentle Puck, come hither. Thou remembrance, since once I sat upon a promontory and heard a mermaid on a dolphin's back. See the image in Shakespeare's mind. Arion has now become the feminine because he's dealing with the feminine energy. So the boy and the dolphin, the mermaid on the dolphin's back. Thou rememberest, since once I sat upon a promontory and heard a mermaid on a dolphin's back uttering such dulcet and harmonious breath that the rude sea grew civil at her song. And certain stars shot madly from their spheres to hear the sea maid's music. In a beautiful language. And Puck says, I remember. So he loves that sort of, when the deep self talks that great high style language, the spirit Mercurius is like good pet tiger. Oh man. It's like that. One of the reasons that man learns to be poetic is to keep that aspect of himself tame. That very time I saw, but thou couldst not. In other words, the deep self says, I could see, even though you could not. Spirit Mercurius is very energetic and capable, but is not the deep self at all. That very time I saw, but thou couldst not. Flying between the cold moon and the earth, Cupid all armed, a certain aim he took at a fair vestal throned by the west, and loosed his love shaft smartly from his bow, as it should pierce 100,000 hearts. Twang! It's like that. But I might see Cupid's fiery shaft quenched in the chaste beams of the watery moon, and the imperial votress pass it on in maiden meditation, fancy free. Yet marked I where the bolt of Cupid fell. It fell upon a little western flower, before milk white, now purple with love's wound. The flower is the nascent person, which in this case didn't emerge, is that little flower in this bank somewhere. And O'Brien says, and he marked where it lay. What is this flower? This before milk white, now purple with love's wound, is the hidden self of Titania. O'Brien is able to see that. And Shakespeare too, quite able. And maidens call it love in idleness. Fetch me that flower, that herb I showed thee once. Why do maidens call it love in idleness? It's a fantasy love. It's a fantasy mode of person. It's not the person at all, just like fantasy. What if, what if? Little daydream romance level. Only instead of it being harmless kind of daydreaming, you're daydreaming about your own person. Deep self needs to cure that. It's a very, very, very bad disease. Fetch me that flower, the herb I showed thee once. The juice of it on sleeping eyelids laid will make or man or woman madly dote upon the next live creature that it sees. Fetch me this herb, and be thou here again ere the Leviathan can swim a league. Because he's going to be there, the deep self is going to be there, and she will wake up, she will recognize the deep self, and the soul and the deep self will be together again. Puck says, I'll girdle round the earth in 40 minutes. Then O'Brien says to himself, having once this juice, I'll watch Titania when she is asleep and drop the liquor of it in her eyes. The next thing then she, waking, looks upon, be it on lion, bear, or wolf, or bull, on meddling monkey, or on busy ape, she shall pursue it with the soul of love. And ere I take this charm from off her sight, as I can take it with another herb, I'll make her render up her page to me. But who comes here? I am invisible, and I will overhear their conference. And then the humans come in, Demetrius and Helena. And of course, they're going through the same problem that Oberon and Titania are going through. It's a case of the woman loving another man, but that man loves another woman, and that woman indeed loves another man. So it's a round robin of miscomplications. And of course, Puck, the spirit Mercurius in the play, wants to bring everything together, but he does it in his puckish way. He can't help but when he's turned loose to make mismatches everywhere. Everything is brought together, but everything is brought together in a mismatch. The deep self knows how to reconcile the opposites in a structural, cosmic way. The spirit Mercurius only knows how to experiment and put it together in odd combinations to see, well, look at that, isn't that strange? Look at who's going together. Oh, look at that, that's amazing. What fools these mortals be? It's like that. So A Midsummer Night's Dream, for our purposes, is an accessible grown-up fairy tale which shows us the magical level in a very, very good way. Compared to Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, which is on the mythological horizon, is about magic in a mythic way. Midsummer Night's Dream is about magic in a magic way. It's just that difference. It's just the difference between Marlowe and Shakespeare. Marlowe was able to tell a good story, but Shakespeare was able to lead the real life. It's just that difference between them. Please continue with your Jung, with your reading. Continue together. Talk to each other. And next week we'll do a little canvassing to see how you're getting along. We'll see if any of you have any idea of what you're reading. Just harmless question or two. No exam, no short quiz, no performance, just an indiscreet question or two. Thank you.